And they, in Japan, they say, when you rake, just rake. That's classic Zen. Suzuki Roshi told me, when you cut the carrots, cut the carrots. When you stir the soup, stir the soup. When you wash the rice, wash the rice. So you get in and do it. You know, in Southeast Asia, they say, when you rake, watch your mind. So in Japan, they're just raking. In Southeast Asia, they stand there, holding the rake. But I'm sorry, but in my kitchen, I want you to cook. I want you to get the work done. I don't want you to be standing around, being mindful. I know there's a lot of advantage to being mindful. I've done my share of it. I've practiced, you know, for a lot of years. Inhale, exhale, count one, two, you know, and so been there, done that, and some of you may be interested in doing that and standing in the kitchen and watching your minds. But I did tell that to Mel Weitzman, my Zen, you know, mentor. He said, it sounds like those monks in Southeast Asia still think their minds are up here. Rather than everything is mind, or activity is also mind, you know, things are mind, activity is mind. So, but anyway. So yeah, it took me a long time. I had to work through all of that. And then where are the recipes for no stress and no effort to produce masterpieces? Where, I thought you were going to tell us what to do so we didn't have to think about it. That's another classic thing, you know? But that's what people, you know, look for. Because if the way you're running, managing your world is not working, you know, it's not your strategy that's the problem. It's that you just need to improve the way you do your strategy. So you need a better recipe. It's not that recipes don't work. It's that you need a better recipe. So yeah. So a woman in Portland decided to study. You know. Was there anybody who'd ever lost a lot of weight and kept it off? Because it's just classic. You get the instructions for dieting, you lose a lot of weight, and then you gain it all back and more. And then you go on, and it's called, you know, it's the yo-yo effect in dieting. So she found 11 people who'd lost at least 25 pounds and kept it off for 5 years or longer. And they had one secret in common. They'd each figured out for themselves how to do it. And the last we heard, she could not get a publisher for her book because 11 New York publishers said,
"What?
We can't publish this. Nobody wants to hear they have to figure it out for themselves. Write a book about dieting." So I'm like, oh God, I'm just... So my book is about no recipe. Is that there's no recipe, finally, for being you. Who's ever done it before? Oh well. So whether you want to hear it or not, here it is. But so I have a few copies, and then but you can also get into the bookstore.
I'll buy one for
me. Oh, you will?
Right up front.
Okay, right up front. Here you go. Oh, then you want me to sign it?
Of course.
Yeah, okay.
That's what the extra $2 is for.
Okay, hold on to it until later. Thank you. So we have time now. If you have any questions or comments or observations or things you want to bring up or share, you're welcome to do so. Yes, sir.
I just want to thank you very much for your energy and who you were. Like when.
Yes, and but.
No. Initial conversation with you and you inviting us to take a walk. Just you being so inviting to explore the space really dismantled my reverence for hierarchy and order and stringent adherence to rules. And I was able to really just be with the isness, and I ended up at the beach taking a very slow, mindful walk.
Oh.
And I'm really working on movement for my thoughts.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome. So very much. Yeah. Somebody's listening to what I say. There's no recipe. Yes, sir.
Earlier, when we started, I think you mentioned that we
often are trying to problem solve and get a goal,
yeah,
and that are trying to move to being supported and receiving.
Yeah.
How do you avoid when you're doing like the crossing or walking or you're stepping in or noticing that that doesn't become a problem in itself? Like trying to do that as well. It becomes another thing that you've got to fit to right. Or, yeah.
Well, classically in the Vipassana, you catch yourself doing that and then you note judging or fixing or something like that. And the idea is that, you know, that's the first step, is noticing it, naming it. The main thing I had to work through in my book is called shame. And after even 40 years of Zen practice, I found out, oh, this is called shame. I am not good enough. I am, you know, I am inherently not good enough. I'm, you know, in essence a loser. So, you know, what am I doing here on the planet? And why can't I get things to come out better? And so on. It's like, and then how can you write a book? So the first step is naming it and noticing. And then you can, and at some point you start to notice, you know, that you have a choice about how to work with it. And you can... you can, you know, shift your focus a little bit. You may focus more on your, you know, with your feet or on the noting or what's going on. And at some point in Vipassana, you know, they suggest you practice loving kindness, meditation, and sympathetic joy, and so on. I over the last couple of years, I started doing gratitude practice. Every morning, you write down 20 things you're grateful for. And I wasn't feeling very grateful at the time, so I write down the floor, the candles, the incense, having a cushion to sit on, the sky, the sun. Oh, there's some sunlight. Oh, sunlight. Okay. After a while you get, oh yeah, and there's my daughter. Okay, all right. So little by little you can have, you know, gratitude instead of, you know, obsessing about the problem. You start, you know, just generating gratitude. So yeah, we have habits like that, which then at some point we're, you know, and as much as anything, once you name it, then you can ask, well, what do I do? You know, name it and then ask for help or what would, and you're asking, you know, in a sense yourself, you're asking, giving yourself choice. This is classic, you know, emotional intelligence, that when there's a problem, you give yourself choices and you create, you know, you can list different choices, what would be, what might work here, what might help, and you keep studying that, what might help, which is also what Suzuki Rishi called beginner's mind. You don't already know what to do, how to solve it, so what should I do, what should I do, how do I work on this, how do I, you know. And sometimes what you realize is, oh, I need more information. Just how does this work? So, see what you can find out. So I must say it's pretty good that you already noticed this. What else? Yes, sir.
Whether it's walking or meditating or anything, the thing that I can be pretty consistently sure of is that thinking is going to be my thing that's going to get in the way, even if there's outdoors and there's other senses going on. And it was good to be able to name it while we were walking. Mm-hmm. But is there any shortcut for short-circuiting the thinking?
Yeah, you know, it's called psilocybin. Magic mushrooms. I mean, it's only a temporary shortcut. My friend Vanya Pommers, who has a center in Austria and Felsenturm, is where I get to go to Europe, because that's two of the places I teach when I'm there. Three Zen and cooking retreats, and then one Zen meditation intensive sesshin at Purig. And Vanya, 2 years ago, I think, in February, he had a sesshin with his spectacular retreat center that's a two-story zendo it's originally constructed the pieces in Emeryville, you know, and then shipped over to Belgium, truck to Switzerland, helicoptered up to the site because there's no roads up there. And incredible vistas. And anyway, had a sesshin where half the people had psilocybin and half didn't. And it's all with Swiss scientists and Swiss professors and through the university and the hospitals. And you can do this kind of thing in Switzerland. Yeah, it's lucky up to a point. My student, Thomas, went, and then he didn't get the psilocybin. He had to sit there for a week while other people were having such a spectacularly great time. And so then, you know, if you didn't get the psilocybin, you got invited back to a two-day retreat later in September. When again, the first day he didn't get the psilocybin, so then he knew the second day it was his turn. So he finally got the psilocybin. But he's very big on dosage, which is why they use psilocybin, because you can dose it to body weight. Dosage, setting, and intention. That this is for spiritual practice and not for just, I'm out of here, I'm getting high. So you have positive intention. And it's, you know, and classically and, you know, historically, this is the way that things have been used, is, you know, for some intention behind it rather than just, I want to get high, I want to get out of here. Interestingly enough, I saw a movie the other night. I love going to there's a bar restaurant I go to, and you don't need to know all this, but it's a little background for the story, in Munich called Schumann's. And I first went there in 2006 because my film director, Doris Dury, you know, took me there. And after a while, you know, I couldn't get in. So I realized if I want to get in here, I need to become friends with Charles. He's the owner and the head guy. So I brought in a copy of my cookbook in German, Das Lächeln der Radieschen, The Smile of the Radishes, which is their version of Tomato Blessings and Radish Teachings. I brought it in and it was signed, you know, to Charles, and I went up to Charles and I said, Charles, my name is Ed, I have a present for you. And Charles says, it's about time. So like this year I took this book and we go through the bar restaurant to the outdoor eating area in the back. It's really sweet. It's a little German, it's a little formal and stuff, but it's a nice place to eat. And I say to the maitre d', there's three for lunch, please. And he says, do you have a reservation? And I say, no, but this is my annual pilgrimage from California, and I have a present for Charles. And he says, please, have a seat. How did we get started on this? Thinking. But you're also reminding me of a story, you know, which is a very interesting, a couple stories. One is the sixth ancestor, you know, otherwise, you know, Wei Ning. He wrote there may not even have been a sixth ancestor, Wei Ning, but he wrote something called the Platform Sutra, or he didn't, but somebody did and said he did because it was good PR or something, you know. And in the Platform Sutra, one translation says the sixth ancestor taught a no thought, no form, non-abiding. So don't think, don't stick to any particular form as the way to, you know, live your life, and don't hang out in the same place, at least not in your head, you know. Don't kind of try to keep the same reality, you know. Don't try to abide somewhere. Be willing to, you know, see what's going on in your feet or whatever, you know. Rather than just staying in your head and say, what's wrong with your feet? Because the classic way we approach it is to have a self behind the eyes somewhere that snipes at things. And it never gets to snipe back because it's a sniper. And that's the way the intelligence works. You know, we set up consciousness. So no thought, no form, no abiding. And then he said, one day he said, I've been teaching no thought, no form, non-abiding. Some of you are taking me literally. And you are making your minds like rocks so that you don't think at all. This is a cause of insentiency. Insentient, you know, sentient beings are beings that are alive and move about and, you know, think. And this is a cause of insentiency, making your mind like a rock. And it's an obstruction to the way. So You know, when I say, don't think, I mean, if you have a thought, think nothing of it. So this is very similar to what happened. You see, I'll tell you what happened when I first started. And I went for my first interview with Suzuki Roshi. And I had no idea what you do in Dokusan. Auspicious Zen master. He's not that tall, but you know, it feels like he is. Anyway, so I sat down, and then after a while he said, not very long, he said, how's your meditation? I said, oh, not so good. And he said, oh, what's not so good? And I said, well, I'm thinking a lot. And he said, what's the problem about thinking? So I looked for it. What's the problem about thinking? And I couldn't find a problem. So all I could come up with was, well, you know, you're not supposed to think. That's what you teach all the time. And he said, I think it's pretty normal to think, don't you? So, again, you know, it's when you believe your thinking is important and you need to keep track of it, then you sit there and think and keep track of it. If you decide that it may be interesting to follow your breath or do something else with your energy or your vitality or this moment, you follow your breath or you know sit up straight or you do something else in the meditation hall and you find things to do in your life that are absorbing and interesting and you know that and thinking has its place. You know, one other story about I once drove a man out of Tassajara and I was talking and I said, how was your time in Tassajara? Oh, it was so hard. And I, what was so hard? He said, well, I couldn't stop thinking. I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop thinking. But he seemed to have done a pretty good job of it. As time went on, we got towards the city, and I said, did you talk to Zen Center about having a place to stay? No, I didn't think of that. And you think you might go on to Gringotts? Did you talk to them? No, I didn't think of that. So the problem is not thinking, but you know that you have a good relationship with it where you can think or not think, and it serves its purpose. And when you need to think, you think, and you know, and the thoughts that would be useful for you come to you, and other thoughts, you know, like, not interested. But sometimes it's a little hard to tell, but you know, anyway.
I have a question, which is kind of about thinking, but so just sitting. So, like you were talking about, the hippies aren't interested in material things, but they want to improve.
Yes.
So I confess, you know, I mean, I'm. Let's face it, I like to be a better person. So I'll just cut to the chase. So what's the question between aspiration and like an agenda? I mean, you know what you're saying? Isn't an aspiration an agenda?
I was going to say, let's pass around the cookies.
Yeah, let's do that.
And ask a cookie.
Yeah. I think so. So I'm saying, so if we're just sit.
You reminded me, for instance, of I do sometimes meditation with people like, do you want love in your life? So usually we think, you know, you have to earn it. Mm-hmm. You have to become a better person in order to get the love. Because if you were a better person, then the reason you're not getting the love you want is because you're not a better person.
Yeah, that's what I think.
So is what you want to be a better person, or do you want love? I mean, so, you know, let's get clear about this, you know. So my conclusion has been, what I want is not to be, I don't care about being a better person, I want love.
Right. Well, there we go.
So if you want love, that's an aspiration. That's like a great you know, lovely desire.
Yes.
I want love.
Yeah.
And but you what you want to do then is not fixate the love on I want your love.
Yeah.
Or the love from this person or this or that, or that I need to do this in order to get the love, or that I, you know, you want it to be independent of all of that.
No manipulation.
No manipulation, no, you know.
No strategy.
Yeah, you just, so if you want love, go ahead, tune to love, receive. This is my, you know, this is be support. You know, find the support wherever you go, find the love wherever you are. And I don't know what happened after Jesus said, oh my God, you know, why hast thou forsaken me? I mean, on the cross,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I know.
Father, why hast thou forsaken me? As Michael Mead said, family business. Bad. Bad family karma. Whoa. But anyway,
he wasn't forsaken because he was resurrected, so, you know, it was just a bad moment.
Yeah, maybe so. But I don't know what resurrected means either.
Me either.
You know, I don't know, like, in the bodily form or in the non-bodily form or...
Yeah, you know, actually nobody really knows.
It's always a little confusing. You know, he was the Son of God, but aren't we all? No, not like he was.
No, I'm with you. I am in the Christian faith, you know, and I'm saying the same thing. It's like, what do you mean? Like, me? How come? What's the diff?
So anyway, aspiration is, you know, aspiration is where it's not attached to getting one thing in order to get another, or, you know, becoming a better person in order to have. You just go for what you want and have what you want and receive what you want, because the big thing is your belief that you need to become a better person in order to receive the love is a mistake. The reason why, you know, you're not receiving love is because you started thinking that. And you started thinking that when you were a child, and you didn't, and that was a good strategy at the time.
Yeah.
I'm going to do my best to earn love. Well, I'll do my best. I'm going to behave well. I'm going to do what they want, and then they'll love me. And you get, you know, but you know, and maybe you get some love, but it's not directly related to that. You know, you get what you through your good deeds and everything. You get approval. You get recognition. You get gratitude or thanks. Thank you for, you know, your good behavior, you know, and so on. But, you know, the love is something you need to be willing to receive. And then sometimes it's in the air and sometimes it's not in certain families. But the more you think, I need to perform in order to have it, probably not. So, you know, it's good to have aspirations.
Right.
I want to be at home. I've, you know, over the years, I want to breathe easy. I want to be at home here in this body, at this place, at this time, on this earth. And that's, but that's not, I want to have a home where I'm safe and secure. It's, I want to be at home wherever I am. So those kind of aspirations are powerful and important. And that's the whole world of affirmations and intentions that I was like, no, I'm working on becoming a better person. I'm going to earn all of this. We're not in woo-woo land here. We're in, you know, hardcore practice land. Yes.
Can you talk more about the woo-woo land? The affirmations?
Oh. Oh, somebody wants to know about woo-woo land and affirmations.
There seems to be more.
Well, you know, a few years back, there was the whole business of The Secret.
Yeah.
Now, that got to be woo-woo land, because they said, whatever you want, you create what you want, and then it will come to you. But what they didn't say is, what you want needs to be in attunement with your core, with your true nature. So, if the more you can voice what is actually in attunement with your core, with your true nature, then, you know, things, and then it can come to you. So, almost every day I put, you know, a little piece of paper on my altar. What's up today, you know? So, you know, safe trip to Europe, you know, good courses, you know, and then you can basket them in, you know, within that, you know, or my relationship, my daughter, you know, So I affirm those things, and then I ask for help. Please help. And sometimes, where I actually learned a lot about this is, you know, I have some amazing friends. I mean, in my view, they're amazing friends. I was at a Zen Center reunion about 2004 or something, I don't know, 2008, I don't know. And I ran into my old roommate from Dasara, Jack Elias. And Jack said, "Hey, how's your bread book? You sold a lot of copies of your bread book, yeah?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You know, I have a book out now too. It's called Finding True Magic. It's doing great." I said, "Oh, that's interesting." And he said, "Yeah, I've become a hypnotherapist. And I have a website called Finding True Magic." So I said, "Well, hey, can I work with you?" And he said, "Well, sure." And I said, "But I'm in San Francisco. I'm in Marin County. You're in Seattle. How do we work?" He said, "On the phone, Ed." So occasionally I work with Jack, but you know, the first couple of times was the most amazing. Each one has been important. And the first time I talked with him, I said, "You know, I'm really scared, unhappy, angry, sad, you know, dread, fear, terror, you know, list them. I mean, you know, depressed, despondent, you know, whatever, you know, pretty much the gamut of, you know, three categories of emotions, you know, anger, frustration, anxiety, worry, and despondent despair. You know, three categories. You can be, you know, against things, you can be worried about how they come out, and you can be discouraged that they're not happening." And it turned out that a lot of that was because I was a type A person. And I'm trying to do too much. And that's the way it works with type A when you're type A. But I talked to Jack and I told him about this, and then we did some work, and then he said, "Okay, Ed, look at it. You know, you're unhappy because you're watching bad movies. You're watching the movies, you're seeing mental pictures that, you know, elicit sadness and anger and frustration. You're watching these same movies over and over again. Why don't you watch some other movies?" "But they're true. It's reality. It's what happened. It's what's going on in my life. And it's true, you know." And he said, "Ed, that's called the trance of everyday reality." Yeah. We're working, you know, with hypnotherapy here, so those are trances that we can dispel, those trances, and we can create other trances. Now we're talking woo-woo. If you tell this to Zen people, oftentimes they say, "No, Ed, we just sit with what is." "And if what is sucks, we just sit with what sucks."
Right, so there's a little disparity there. Right?
Yeah. So I don't know that this is not Zen. It's not your typical Zen. So he told me these various things. And so at some point we stopped talking, and then I hung up the phone and I went to sleep on this solid wood floor for 2 hours. I thought, wow, that's fabulous. Isn't that amazing? I just went to sleep for 2 hours. And then a few days later, we talked on the phone again. "Ed, what happened?" And I said, "Oh, it's amazing. I had this great nap, slept for 2 solid hours after a phone call." And he said, "Ed, we call that resistance." So then we went over and over this. And then he said, "You're watching movies that make you unhappy, that make you sad, that make you scared, that make you angry. You're watching these same movies. Why don't you watch some other movies?" "I don't know what other movies to watch." "Ed, you're in charge of the movie theater. Bring in some other movies." "Well, what other movies would I bring in?" "Ed, you're the screenwriter, you're the director, you're the cinematographer. You can bring in whatever actors you want. Make some new movies, create some other movies. You know, don't keep watching these same movies." But it's not reality, it's not true, it's not what happened to me. I need to keep my story." And he said, "But when you keep your story, you're unhappy, so why are you doing that?" And I said, "But, you know, it's what happened, you know? My mother died when I was 3, okay? I mean, it's what happened. And then I was in the orphanage, and, you know, and it's, you know, it's how I remember my mother and honor her, you know, to keep feeling her feelings for her, even though she's not here." Whatever, you know, you have this rationale. like, because you don't know any better than to watch, you know, the same old movies. So he was so persistent. It's what, you know, it's what in that world, you know, you call relentless compassion. Or something like this, you know, it's just completely relentless. And, you know, please don't do this to me. You know, you really, you know. And he just kept at it until finally I said, okay, all right, I understand. I'm watching some bad movies. I could watch some other ones. How do I do this? So he said, so glad you asked. He didn't say that, but he said, oh, thank you, good. And then he said, so you try this. You say, okay, now, Ed, would you like to be happy and joyful? So I said, yeah, that sounds good, happy and joyful, I could go for that. And so then he said, all right, so if, you know, being scared comes up, you just say, even though I'm scared, I will be joyful and happy. Or you can say, I'm scared, nevertheless, I will be joyful and happy. Either even though or nevertheless. I'm scared, nevertheless, I will be joyful and happy. Even though I'm scared, I will be joyful and happy. I'm angry, nevertheless, I will be joyful and happy. Even though I'm angry, I will be joyful and happy. So I started doing that. And, you know, one thing after another would come up. And, you know, several times an hour, you know, I'm scared, nevertheless, I will be joyful and happy. And it would pop, it would go away, it was gone. And then, I'm angry, nevertheless, I will be joyful. I'm so discouraged, nevertheless, I will be joyful and happy. And after about 3 days, it all just was gone. That's woo-woo. That's serious woo-woo. And I don't know if you have to believe it or not, but you know, you do have to do the work. I mean, you have to say, okay, I'm going to watch some other movies. Okay, I don't have to stick to this story about who I am and what my life is about and why it doesn't work and what I need to do to fix it and, you know, why can't I do that? And you don't, you know, at some point it's like, screw it. Get on with your new life. So it's a little bit like in Zen, the saying, setting aside what enlightenment would be like, if you had it, what would you do with it? Mm-hmm. Excuse me, but do you really need to be enlightened to do that? Give yourself some permission. Anyway, there's many versions of that. But I that was my first, you know, practical encounter. And so then I called up Jack and I said, whoa, this is like finding true magic. So I'm going up to Seattle in September and I'll probably see him. I haven't seen him in all these years, but I refer people to him. And coincidentally, we're both working with a group called One Taste. Do you know One Taste? Mm-hmm. They practice Omin. You know, O-O-M for orgasmic meditation. Omin. Jack and I don't, I mean, as far as I know, Jack doesn't practice with them. I don't practice that with them. I teach meditation and outdoor walking and Qigong and, you know. And he works with them on the phone mostly, but occasionally does retreats with them. So we may collaborate and do a retreat together with the One Taste people. They've come here two or three times and they're much better than they were many years ago. You missed it. You know, 10 years ago they were here, 30 of them. And in the dining room, you know, they, at lunchtime they were sitting in each other's laps. And at the end of the very end of the day, I got up from my cushion, you know, where I'm sitting, and there was a woman on the other side of the zendo there, and she was bending over to straighten her cushion, like I talked to you about this morning. And as far as I could tell, she didn't have anything on but black panties. And I thought, well, it's embarrassing, you know, you don't want to keep looking at something like this. And I forgot that I'm the teacher and I probably should say something about wearing clothes in the meditation hall. You know, you forget, like, it's up to, oh, I'm the authority here, I should say something, you know. Little did I know. So I went back to straightening my cushion, and when I turned around, she had her clothes on. So it worked. worked out. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to take a few minutes now to straighten my cushion. In the meantime, if you all could get dressed. I'll tell you one more thing, which I just got yesterday, which is so, I just found this so interesting because I'm 73 now. Why didn't I hear this sooner? And the person I was working with yesterday said, you know, the more you can appreciate how much work and effort you made as a baby and as a young child to survive in this world and how to do it here, and the more you can appreciate and honor that all the effort that you did that got you through your early life, the more that energy is going to, you know, it's going to be here in your life today. So when I look at my, you know, 3 or 4 year old, oh, he's so unhappy, so miserable. But, you know, yesterday when we were talking about it, like, that's when I decided I was going to survive. And nothing was going to stop me. And that energy is still here. And I'm honoring that now. I'm going to do this. You know. And we all did that. We all went through, you know, amazing, amazing effort. And I mentioned this morning, 2 months old, you learn as a baby, prone, to lift your head and look around. Huge shift. And then between around 3 and a half, huge expansion of the frontal lobes. It's so huge that each neuron is now making connections with 100 other neurons. And given that there's millions of neurons, this is a 100-fold increase in your intelligence at the age of 3 and a half, or whenever that happens. So, you know, you figured out how to do this. What to do with that? And yeah, certain things were hard, but you know, you figured out a lot, and you made it, and you survived all of that, and you know, you've been working on a lot of things all these years. And, you know, so, you know, the more you honor, you know, all of your, the more we honor our huge effort, our huge, you know, the great accomplishment it is to even be here. The more we honor that, the more that energy is here today for us too. And we don't just go like, oh yeah, that sucked. So that's kind of, again, a different view. And that's not so woo-woo in my world. That has a little more reality to it. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, I started practicing with you the first time in 85.
I was thinking it's probably been about 20 or 25 years. Or 30.
And in all the thousands of hours of meditation since that time, right, I have remembered something you said the very first time.
And now we get to hear it. If we're lucky.
It was, if you are coming to meditation for any particular thing, you will get nothing. There is nothing to get from meditation. Nothing. No.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. I was serious, was I? Same message today.
Same message. You know,
but a little.
There's nothing special.
A little softer.
Yeah, a little softer.
It's the Soto message.
Yeah. Sweet. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Yes.
Just following up on the clothing. When can you tell us a little bit about what you were wearing?
Oh, the clothes. Yeah, you know, in Zen we have outfits. I was at a Buddhist teacher's retreat at Spirit Rock, you know, about 10 years ago, 12, 15 years ago. And they had little, what they called home groups, so you were paired with not exactly paired, but you were in groups of, you know, the Zen people were put in these, there was 8 or 10 people in a group, and so I was with some Vipassana people, some Tibetans, some Zen people, you know, there's 10 or 12 people. And we all introduce ourselves, and I happen to be sitting next to Joseph Goldstein. So I'm sitting there, black, you know, black pants, not gray, but black Hippari, and this is a roksu. This is a miniature Buddhist robe, which the Chinese and the Japanese liked. As far as, you know, I would guess is that in Asia, with the big robe that you wear over your left shoulder and under your right shoulder, and you tuck it in somewhere, and in Asia, it was saffron, and the Tibetans have maroon ones, and the Chinese and Japanese and Koreans like gray and black, and sometimes brown or tan or something. You know, and in India originally, as a monk, you weren't supposed to work. You just lived by begging. And the Chinese did not like that. So they're the ones who, like, yo, let's have our arms free to do some work. So they, as far as I can tell, that's where this came from. And traditionally, you got scraps of cloth and then purified them and then sewed them and dyed them and sewed them together. So we mostly take new material, cut it up, and sew it together. But I saw some magnificent roksus in the Zen Center of Los Angeles that are done with different colored fabric. Oh, man. Why don't we all do that? It's like art, you know? It's like, and then, anyway. So I was sitting next to Joseph Goldstein, and there were 3 Tibetan teachers across from us, Dzogchen Rinpoche, Gelug Rinpoche, and Sogyal Rinpoche. And after we'd introduced ourselves, Dzogchen Rinpoche looked across at me and he said, and this is so Tibetan, you know, so Ed, what's the difference between you and Joseph? Got your bullet point, you know, like what's Zen and what's Vipassana and, you know, what the difference is. And you know, you're supposed to be articulate about all these things. And I said, well, we have short hair, and we have outfits, and they don't. Look at it. He's in a cardigan sweater, and you know, and his hair is much longer than mine. And Dzogchen Rinpoche looks across at me and he said, no, Ed, I'm serious. And damn, to this day, I'm wishing, you know, that I knew enough to say, and I guess that's the difference between you and me. And instead of like, oh, I'm so ashamed. I don't have the, you know, the little 2 sentences for you about the difference here. You know, oh, we just sit and they practice noting or whatever, you know, your bullshit you want to talk about. You know. Oh, yeah. So then, you know, when you do these, then you give it to your teacher and they write on, writes on the back of it. So someone made this for me. I don't remember Marjorie. Who. This is Marjorie's too?
Did Marjorie make that for you?
Marjorie made the new one. Did she make this one too?
No.
Because this one says, ascending the mountain seat of Yoshinji, January 1st, 2014, year of the horse. So I have a little backyard zendo, and then I became the abbot of my backyard zendo. With a, you know, big ceremony. 35 or 40 of my friends came, and we had this ceremony, and then I received this roksu. And then it says, the deep ocean of tranquility holds the mountain form in its loving embrace. And that's, you know, Mel only writes classic poems. He doesn't make any of this stuff up. So, and my Buddha's name is Longevity Mountain, Peaceful Sea. Mm-hmm. So the deep ocean of tranquility holds the mountain form in its loving embrace. Yeah. So this morning for a few minutes I had lost the rocks I've been wearing recently, which is one that Marjorie made, my student in Seattle. And then so I pulled this one out and I thought, oh, ascending the mountain seat of Yoshinji. Yoshinji, by the way, is Nourish Heart Zen Temple, mm-hmm. My backyard zendo. So this is also reminding me that I'm going to put out some sheets of paper for an email list. If any of you would like to be on the list of, you know, to receive information about events at my backyard zendo and or other locations, you could put your name on the list. And I can put these over in the zendo too, eventually. But if If in the meantime you want to be on one of these lists, you can.
So who was Abbott before you?
Oh, I was the first. Okay, sir, here. And we're coming to an end. It is 2:40. Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's a big deal. These are, you know, you sew these yourself. For the most part, I'm in this position now where people seem to be sewing them for me. But, you know, and it takes about a week. You know, at least your first one, probably 40 hours or more.
It took me a year and a half.
Well, you weren't working on it 8 hours a day, you know, either were you? I'm talking about where you sit down and, you know, it's sewing intensive. No, I understand it can take a year and a half. So, but you study with a sewing teacher, and then you ask your teacher first of all for permission, and to receive precepts. And we do a ceremony with 16 Bodhisattva precepts, and then and classically at the Zen Center they have periods of time where you should have been practicing for 3 years this, and you should have done that, and so on. And then you can ask for permission, and then you study with a sewing teacher, and you get the fabric, and you cut it all out. Then you have to sew each of these lines, and there's a procedure first. You sew the vertical pieces together, then you sew the stripes this way, then you sew these together so they're together, then you have to sew around the outside and so on, and you sew the straps. And so a week to a year and a half. And then each time you make a stitch, you say, I take refuge in Buddha, or you say it in Japanese, Namu Kie Butsu. And I don't know, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's a great religious experience, or, you know, it's something to do to pass the time. It takes, you know, it's, I don't know, you decide, you know. How do you want to spend your time? I think it's a, you know, after a while, you know, and then some people become...
Well, I combined it with dinner at Hastie Grill.
Oh, yeah, Anne used to go to the now, you went to class first?
I went to Hastie Grill.
You went to Hastie Grill first, and then you went to sewing class?
Yes.
But, you know, weren't you having a martini when you were at the Hastie Grill?
A
martini.
Oh, okay. So she just, you know, usually there might be more, but on the days that she, the night she was going to be sewing at the Zen Center, just one martini at the Hastie Grill.
Good job on one martini.
Thank you.
So, please meet my student, Anne. And she could show you the back of her rock. So I peeked at it earlier, and it says Buddha on the spot. And
which
this is, which is Dogen, which is Dogen.
Say?
Yeah, I wrote it.
Yeah, you wrote it.
Buddha on the spot, and Buddha on the spot is from Dogen's teaching, aim to hit the mark. And hitting the mark is to realize your Buddha on the spot without changing anything about your body or mind. Without changing anything, you're Buddha on the spot.
Is that when you reach the Dharma name? Is when you finish the rakshu?
Yeah, then when you finish the rakshu and you have the ceremony, and then you receive your Dharma name, yeah.
Dharma name? Mine is Topo Chokan.
Okay, we're